few more verses this week. Remember, last week we just did chapter 9, verse 9. This week we're going from 10 through 13. I want to challenge us this morning as we begin to remember that we just have snapshots in the Bible of everything that Jesus did, probably even things that he said. The Apostle John, near the end of his gospel, says this, as if he wrote down everything that Jesus ever did, then the book it would be contained in would fill up the whole world. And so we understand that and we know that, but we do understand this as well, and that is God has given us everything that we in fact do need to know about Christ and about his ministry and about what that ministry means to us. We know about the gospel because it's written down in this book that we call the Bible. And I pray that we would all understand that it encompasses far more than just us coming to salvation. It encompasses every breath that we take from now into into eternity. We need the gospel every day, every one of us. And I just want to encourage all of us to remember that. It would be very helpful to every single one of us if at least once a day we basically preach the gospel of grace to ourselves all over again. Because we are very forgetful people. It's very easy for us to fall into a slump. It's very easy for us to forget that we are saved by grace and grace alone. And when we do that, guess what happens? We begin to judge very harshly other people. And we begin to lose sight of our own sin, the gravity of our own sin. But we also have to be reminded constantly that Jesus has said to us, follow him, and we've done that. And in essence, in doing that, he has said to us, your sins have been forgiven you. Just remember, last week we studied the calling of Matthew. And Jesus said those words to him that he'd said to Andrew and Peter and James and John sometime before that, bidding him to follow him. And he did. This follows on the tail of that. And it happened that as he was reclining at the table in the house, behold, tax gatherers and sinners came and were dining with Jesus and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, why is your teacher eating with tax gatherers and sinners? And when he heard this, he said, is it not those who are healthy who need a physician, but it is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire compassion and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. If you're a sinner, Jesus just said to you that he came here for a reason, and you were part of that reason. And that reason was to call you. In Matthew, it doesn't really tell us which house this was in reference to. That's one of the reasons that God gives us all these different gospels, because where one maybe leaves out a detail, the other ones happen to fill it in. We do know for Mark and Luke that this in fact was a house of Matthew. So what we have here is this man that Jesus had come upon, and we know that he left where he was that day and he was on a mission, and the mission was to go to where Matthew was to call him. And we know that immediately that Matthew got up from where he was, he left his old life behind, and he began on that day to follow Jesus. But one of the things that happened was this, was because of this great and wonderful thing that had happened in Matthew's life, he decided to throw a big party, a banquet. And I think probably for a couple of reasons, and we're not really told the reason here, but I think we can read some things out of what we do know. And one of those things is we know this because every one of us has come to faith, that there is a sense of celebration. And so part of this is Matthew celebrating his new life. The point in life when he is leaving behind the old and he's taking up the new. We also have a sense that this is a party that he throws in honor of his Savior. a man that he just knew just a short time before this. And now this man has changed his life, and he has this great passion, this great love for Christ. He knows from the very get-go that even though we're told that he gave up everything, that in reality he didn't give up anything, that he's gained everything from his association with Jesus. He's celebrating. And he asks those who are close to him to come and share in his celebration. Just remember this, that when all this was going on here in the world, that there was celebration in heaven over Matthew's conversion. So what we're saying is this party really is more of a reflection of a greater party that's going on in the heavenly places, where Jesus is, and the angels are gathering, and they are praising God because of the salvation that has come to this disciple called Matthew. Have you ever thought about that in regard to yourself? It's funny, we celebrate all kinds of things in this world. We have parties for lots of different occasions, for birthdays, for anniversaries, for graduations. We have set a party atmosphere for the reception after weddings. I don't remember ever anyone throwing a party to celebrate their conversion. Do you know of anyone? Why not? Out of everything in life that we celebrate, there's nothing that ought to even come close to it. And we don't even follow the biblical pattern that's established. Maybe we should have a late party for all of us sometime. All of this, my friends, every time we get together, and we do these things on occasion, we get together and we party with each other at different times. But anytime we're gathered with believers and we're in that kind of an atmosphere, we should always be mindful of the greater party that's coming. You see, we've been given an invitation, and it's invitation that's not given to everybody. It is in a sense, but in another sense, it's not. To be at the marriage supper of the Lamb. Let me tell you, that's a party. You may miss some parties here in this world that you wished you hadn't, but that's a party you'd never want to even think about missing. It's going to be the greatest, the grandest celebration that's ever taken place in all of eternity. So great, so wonderful, you and I cannot even begin to imagine all that it's going to encompass and what it's going to be like and what the atmosphere is going to be like. Can you imagine being in a group of people where there is no atmosphere of sin? There is not that fog any longer, no darkness, no blackness, no anything. It's all gone and everything is brilliantly white light of purity and perfection. Well, Matthew, like you very often find, when he first meets Jesus, one of the first things he wants to do is to introduce him to the other people around him that he was close to. If you look at the first chapter of John, we find that pattern established with a couple of the apostles. Andrew, the brother of Peter, was the first one. The first thing he did was went to Peter to bring him to Christ. Philip, who becomes one of the apostles, the same thing in reference to Nathanael. These men, when they became believers, when they were converted, the first thing that they could do, the first thing they even thought about doing was telling other people that they in fact had found the Messiah, that they had found the Savior. I would imagine there are people in this room that did similar things. And when we first came to faith, we desperately wanted other people to know what we knew. And some of those friends that we knew that may have been on the teeter-totter, they weren't even near the playground. We would tell them about what it meant to us. And let me tell you, that was especially sweet for me because I was one of those people that everyone said, he will never become a Christian. Who did you tell? When was the last time you told anybody? Jesus came on a mission, my friends, and part of that mission was to save Matthew. Now, like I said before, we don't have the whole ball of wax here. We don't know what really became of all of this. We don't know how many people were at this party that actually eventually came to faith in Jesus. We do know there were some Pharisees there, and we do know there are a few Pharisees who actually did come to faith in Christ eventually. So some of the folks in this party, it may have been like the men's fellowship breakfast. They knew a little bit about God. I would imagine most of them were Jews. Knew a little bit about God, but maybe they didn't know a whole lot about God. Maybe they practiced religion, but it was very empty and meaningless religion. But when they left that room that day, they knew that something was amiss. They knew this was something like nothing they had ever experienced before. They knew there really must be something to this man named Jesus. Well, just remember this, that very often when you're a working man, a lot of the people that you're closest to are the people that you work with. And just remember that Matthew was, in essence, an IRS agent, tax agent. So who do you think his friends would have been? The people he took taxes from? Not likely. But probably the people who shared the same profession. It surprises a mess out of these Pharisees that Matthew invites these tax gatherers to his party, but it should not surprise us at all because these are probably the people that Matthew, at least in some ways, was closest to in life. These were the guys that he wanted them to experience what he's experiencing Christ at this point. As a believer, it's very often very easy to fall into this thing, and that is where we spend all of our time with believers. We come to church on Sunday morning, and that's a very good thing. We go to Bible study maybe once or twice a week, and that's a very good thing. Most of our friends are church people. Most of the people we consider to be family very often are church people. And I want to encourage you this morning that your best, very best friends should be believers, people that you confide in, the things of your heart and your soul. They need to be believers. But we also need to be challenged to understand that we need to have unbelievers in our lives. We do. How in the world can we ever carry out the Great Commission if the only people we ever talk to about Jesus with are fellow believers? We cannot disconnect ourselves from the world. Now, I'm not encouraging us to be like the world and act like the world and behave like the world and think like the world and have lives that look very worldly. That's not what we're talking about. But it's very easy for us to be like the Pharisees. thinking, why in the world would we so associate ourselves with so-and-so? They are a dirty, rotten blank. It might spoil my reputation if some people saw me with so-and-so. And this here, Jesus could care less about that stuff. I would imagine he is delighting with his whole heart in Matthew's wholehearted response to his conversion. Jesus, my friends, spent a lot of time with unbelievers. And we need to do the same thing. Relationships with other people, vitally important to our work for Christ in this world. I know that some of you are loners. You need to understand my proneness is to be a loner too. It really is. But that is not God's intention for any of us. Not now. Not ever. Maybe you can't find someone that you like well enough to spend time with them. That's not the issue. Matter of fact, those are the people you probably need to spend time with. Be careful that you are an influence upon other people and that other believers are an influence upon you, but be very careful that the world is not your greatest influence. It is a formula for disaster. So here we have these Pharisees that are passing judgment. You need to understand something. They are passing judgment on the Son of God. Who is he? What gall does he have to sit here and eat dinner with tax gatherers and sinners? Now, we all know this, that, you know, Christ could have stuck out his finger and shot a lightning bolt at him and fried him on the spot, right? But Jesus knew that. He understood us. And Jesus says this, he says, he heard that, and he said, it's not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. You see, in God's eyes, there were no people in that room that were innocent. These Pharisees were convinced that they were. They were God's people. They were teachers of the law. They were religious leaders. They had great influence in the Jewish community. But their religion, my friends, according to Jesus, was absolutely worthless. And rather than it being a blessing to God, it was an affront, a direct assault in the face of God himself. Because they taught salvation by works, by their own good works. They believed that by keeping the law that they made themselves right with God, and that they were heaven bound. How many people do you think in this world today have the same mindset? You need to understand something, that Christianity is a religion of faith, and all of them are in some degree, but you have to understand that the big difference is, what is your faith in? That ultimately every other religion comes down to this, and that is, your faith is in yourself, in your own ability to keep the rules and regulations, whatever they happen to be, regarding whichever religion it happens to be you're talking about. We know this. We know there's only one way to heaven, and that is through Christ. That he has done for us what we don't do for ourselves, that we are righteous in a sense. God declares us righteous, but it's not because of what we've done. It's because of what Christ has done for us. In completeness. Finished work. A done deal. I would imagine there was a time when people just went to the doctor, called the doctor, when they really needed the doctor. Some lady was about to deliver a baby, somebody had pneumonia, someone broke their leg. Today, things have gotten to be somewhat different. We have well baby checkups, right? Take the baby to the doctor. When I was a child, my parents were very faithful in making sure that we went to see our physician once every 6 months, much to our chagrin. And it was such an event that they never let us know until like an hour before we were supposed to go, because they didn't want to hear us crying and all that for days before we went. You see, we went to a guy named Dr. Edwards, who was a pediatrician in Ocala for years and years and years. He was a little on the gruff side. You know, I can honestly tell you I was probably afraid of him when I was a kid. He was not real tender and gentle and all of that. And he seemed to just love shots. And he seemed to get some kind of sick pleasure in giving little kids shots. Because every time you went, you're getting a booster for this. I thought I got a booster for that last time. Oh, well, you need another one. We got shots, shots, shots. And then there was Mrs. Burgess, his nurse. The Wicked Witch of the West might be a better name for her. And the thing that she always did, she usually gave us the shots too. But remember when they used to prick your finger? They didn't have these little nice little things now. They made this little teeny tiny hole, like a little needle that you can hardly even see, and they get a little drop of blood out of it. They used to have like a dagger or something that they shoved into the end of your finger to get blood out of it. Remember that? And that hurt. It hurt something awful. And she seemed to delight in doing it, which made it even worse. I'm sure that we've probably were better off in some ways because we had those regular checkups. I tell you guys, I'll be honest with you, I'm having a hard time scheduling appointments to come visit people. For a lot of reasons, and one of the reasons is this, and this is the same thing with my mom and dad. Today, my mom and dad are older, they're in their 80s. When I'm going to come see them, I have to check on them to make sure they don't have a doctor's appointment before I come, because it's like every day of the week, or at least two or three days a week, one or the other one's going to the doctor. Doctor visits have become more and more a part of American life. Some of you can remember when doctors used to make house calls. I can. I can remember two or three times when I was just really sick when I was a kid, and there's no way I could go to the doctor, and the doctor would actually come to me. I can remember him coming into the room with that black bag and opening it up. And he just did the thing to you there that he was going to do at the office. There was always a shot involved. You notice here that sometimes Jesus makes house calls, that Jesus made a house call. Remember Peter's mother-in-law? Remember the demoniac? He made that special trip all the way across the Sea of Galilee just to see this one person and cast the demon out. Jesus is called the great physician, but he's a physician of another sort. Can he heal physically? You betcha. Can he heal spiritually as well? You betcha. Some of us need physically a physician sometimes. But the truth is, every one of us needs the great physician Jesus all the time. No exceptions. He is the only cure for the disease that we all have in common, not only with everyone else in this room, but everyone else has ever lived in this world, with the exception of Jesus himself. You see, the Pharisees were calling other people sinners and denying that they themselves were such. Do you understand that when we come across to the world as just being a bunch of self-righteous people, that they're reacting to us probably the same way that the tax gatherers and sinners were reacting to the Pharisees. Someone very wise one time said this. I heard them say this with their own mouth, and they said this, that the world will never be serious about us until we're serious with the world about our own sin. We have to get down off of our self-righteous pedestals and mingle with the riffraff. Because Jesus is the one that pulled us up out of the riffraff. That's where we were, all of us. And he set us upon the sure footing. But go and learn what it means, what this means. I desire compassion and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Well, let me get this straight, Pastor. Are you reneging on what you told me last week? That following Jesus meant giving up every worldly thing? That sounds to me like that's a sacrifice. And now Jesus is saying here that he doesn't want sacrifice. That what he wants is compassion. I thought that remind those first five or six chapters in Leviticus about nothing but sacrifice. Isn't they more about sacrifice in the Old Testament law? Was sacrifice going on in Jerusalem right at the time that Jesus was talking? Probably. Did Joseph and Mary go to the temple after Jesus' birth and give the sacrifice to redeem the firstborn son? Confused. Well, sacrifice is part of it. But the issue is this, is it's not the whole lump sum. We have to understand that in God's eyes, this is how sacrifice is measured. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. O God, thou wilt not despise. See, people can sacrifice all kinds of things. Worldly goods, even their lives in a lot of ways, loved ones, etc. Jesus desires sacrifice, but it's only sacrifice that comes from a contrite heart. And let me tell you something, if you have a contrite heart, you will also have, guess what? Compassion. What he's challenging these guys to understand is this, is you don't have a right heart because you don't have compassion. You're not contrite. You don't have compassion. If you were contrite, if your heart was contrite, your life would be defined by a lot of things, but one of those would be compassion. This is what self-righteousness breeds. Among other things, no compassion. No sense of mercy. And it's an ugly picture. It's a very ugly picture. Later on, in Matthew, Jesus will say this to the scribes and the Pharisees, emphasizing over and over their hypocrisy. You're hypocrites because you shut off the kingdom of heaven from men. You're hypocrites because you devour widows' houses. You're hypocrites because you travel on sea and land and make one proselyte, and then you make him into twice the son of hell as you are yourselves. You tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, like justice and guess what? Compassion and faithfulness. You clean the outside of the cup, but inside you're full of robbery and self-indulgence. You're like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but inside they are full of dead men's bones. Jesus did not come to call the self-righteous. He came to call sinners, people who know that they need him. And the only way for you to know that you need him is to own up to your sin, to understand that you're a sinner just like everyone else in this room. And as long as we're all sinners, let me tell you, life is never going to be perfect. There's going to be bumps in the road. There's going to be potholes in the road. The real issue comes down to this, and that is, what do you do with those potholes and those bumps when they come? There are a lot of self-righteous people, but reality is this, is we know that there is no such a thing as a self-righteous person. It's a myth. Except for Jesus. You ever wonder, you ever say things like this to yourself? I would never do that. Spiders joined us this morning. See him coming down the... I'm surprised I didn't even see him, but he's there. You ever have thoughts like that? You ever find yourself being very judgmental of other people without even giving any thought to the idea that maybe I do the same thing? How often do we justify doing something ourselves and then see other people do it and we already condemn them for doing it? See, we always have excuses for ourselves. Always. I tell you what I found is this, guys. Is that people who seem to focus in on the faults and failures of other people, the things that they gripe most about in regard to those people, very often are only a reflection of the way they are. I've seen it over and over and over again. There's a particular person that I know of that calls people liars all the time, and I will honestly tell you, they probably are the premier liar I've ever known in my whole lifetime. Never complain about other people complaining. That ought to really get our attention, right? How do you wiggle out of that one? See, my friends, what comes out really and truly is a measure of where our heart is. Jesus addresses this. He says, it's not what goes in your mouth that messes you up inside. It's what's inside that comes out of your mouth. So where is our heart? That's what it comes down to. Where is our heart? As long as we remember something, we're okay. And that is, we always need Jesus. You ever wonder why God leaves a little vestige of sin in us after we come to faith? You ever wonder about that? He could take care of it then, right? Why does he make us go through the rest of this life with that sin every now and then raising its ugly head and bringing destruction in its path? Why does he do that? certainly for a lot of reasons, but one of them is this. It's because as long as you and I are in this world, as long as that vestige of sin is there, we must in fact constantly realize that with every passing moment, we need Jesus. We need Jesus, as much of Jesus as we can possibly have of Jesus. If we were not constantly reminded of that, we would literally be a bunch of stuck-up, prideful, self-righteous people. It's only that one little thing that reminds us over and over again that we're not. That we sit right with God, but it's only because He came to us and He found us and He called us to follow Him and He enabled us to do that. How can anybody be prideful about that? What I'm telling you is you contributed absolutely nothing to it. God did it. Amazingly. That He bothered. That it was so important to Him that it cost Him the most precious thing He had. Thanks be to God for His kindness and mercy and continued compassion upon us.